The next case this morning is number 043140, Haubenfeld against the Anon Corporation.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm John Pence on behalf of objector and appellant Hannah Feldman. This is a securities class action case, a settlement of a securities class action, a case that was filed against Aon Corporation in 2002. The case was filed on the heels of an SEC investigation, which, in the words of class counsel, ultimately cleared Aon of any wrongdoing. And I refer to that to a statement made on page 6 of their brief, where they concede that the major stock decline was primarily associated with the SEC investigation. So the case was filed on the heels of that investigation, and when that investigation essentially turned up nothing and the SEC threw in the towel, class counsel did likewise. So I think it would be hard not to characterize this securities settlement as a nuisance value settlement, given what's in the record and what, in fact, class counsel concede in their brief about the weaknesses of the case. In the context of that settlement, class counsel requested and the court approved an award of 30% in attorney's fees to class counsel. And the court really did not explain its basis for that award, but it's clear from the absence in the record of any evidence of what the market rate for securities class counsel would be, that the court certainly did not base it on the Seventh Circuit standard of the market rate. And the court, in fact, did not look at anything outside of prior judicial decisions in awarding the 30% fee. Essentially, this case really comes down to an argument about whether historical averages represent market rates. And I think it's clear that they do not, for two reasons. Or at least two reasons. First of all, in a market, the price of any commodity today is not necessarily what it was in 10 years ago or even last year. So the cases relied on or cited by class counsel and therefore presumably relied on by the district court below are not accurate reflections of what the market rate was in 2002, which is the relevant time period, because that's when lead counsel selected its counsel and presumably or should have negotiated a retainer agreement. Also, the more important reason is these cases are not reflective of any kind of market rate, but they're really only reflective of what a court awarded. They did not emerge from pre-suit negotiation between the client and counsel. In fact, they're simply evidence of agreements between counsel and judges, or in cases where fees are paid separately, from a fund, agreements between class counsel and defendants. And I call them agreements simply because in a typical case where a class counsel comes in and asks for a given fee and there are no objectors and the defendant has agreed not to oppose the fee, the judge is faced with a choice. He can either approve that fee and know that the case will go away, or he can decide to award another lower fee and have the chance that the case would be appealed and he might be reversed on appeal. So essentially judges have historically, granted the fees requested.
Do you really believe that trial judges care whether they're reversed? The salary remains the same. Do they think you have a personal interest in the case?
No, not a personal interest. But
what's the fear of being reversed?
I misspoke. Not a fear, but certainly if the case is reversed and remanded, then the court has to go through another analysis on remand.
Well, you asked for an analysis in the first instance. We're back to he gets paid by a month. What if he does another analysis? It doesn't bother him. We reverse a lot of district courts.
Right.
I hadn't noticed them being in trembling fear or doing anything in fear of
trying. I don't mean to imply that they're all in fear or intimidated by this court, but just that
sometimes I wish they were.
As far as docket management goes, perhaps they wouldn't welcome a remand. And I think the Synthroid case illustrates the the extra work that it can cause the district court if its fee award is reversed and then there's a remand and it has to go through another analysis. In fact, the historical averages and that method of setting a fee actually precludes a market rate because the historical average is inherently conservative. We have a database of cases that's 2,000, and I use that figure because that's the latest number from the latest study by Class Action Reports. I believe it was by Logan and Moore. But they surveyed 2,000 class action settlements and found that the historical average was 31%, or pretty close to that figure. You could have 50 cases in a row that awarded a 10% fee, and it wouldn't budge that average very much at all. So if you're going to have a market rate, you have to disregard these historical averages, or at least not look back 10 years, because that's going to inherently preserve the stasis of the current system.
Did your client tell the district court about her objections? How did she phrase her objections in the district court?
Do you mean in her written objections?
Yeah, all this stuff you're telling us now. Did you tell the district court all this?
No, it was not as elaborate as my brief or my argument here today. However, she cited to Synthroid and also to ComDisco in her objection. Therefore, for the defendants to say there was no evidence provided of any other negotiated fees is in fact wrong. It's incorrect because ComDisco cites, I believe, several auction fees, and Synthroid cites both negotiated fees and auction cases. And in fact, Synthroid was a negotiated fee of 22%. So there is evidence there that when fees are negotiated, they're always less than 30%. So simply because courts have awarded 30% in the past, and that's a descriptive observation, doesn't mean that courts should award 30% in the future, which would be a normative mandate. There's no connection there between what has happened historically and what should happen now that this circuit, at least, has announced a rule that it wishes the market rate to be used. I believe the origins of the 30% fee are taken from personal injury law, and that was the fee that traditionally a personal injury lawyer would receive. It's completely arbitrary the way that was borrowed and applied to securities cases. And I think it's especially today because, to my knowledge, there are no firms that do securities class action counsel and also do personal injury work. There are two distinct markets today. It may be that at the beginning of this practice area, the plaintiff's lawyers did securities work, but that's no longer, personal injury lawyers did securities work. But that's no longer the case. So there's no longer any basis to follow that 30% fee or 33% fee, which has been handed down from some other practice area. There's no indication that ever resulted from some period when fees were actively negotiated between clients and counsel. With regard to the argument respecting the lead plaintiff, and I think the defendants are incorrect to say that I somehow waived that because I originally thought the Taubenfelds were the lead plaintiffs. In fact, they're only the named, class representatives. The lead plaintiff is Caldwell and Orkin, but my argument is essentially that nobody, not the Taubenfelds, not Caldwell and Orkin, or no other class member, stepped forward and acted as an adequate lead plaintiff here. And in fact, what is the only purpose of a lead plaintiff under the PSLRA is, in fact, to monitor class counsel, to select and monitor class counsel. And certainly one large aspect of that would be to negotiate a fee that minimizes the amount the class must give up to its counsel. And I think here we have to presume that the lead plaintiff did not do that, not only because no fee agreement was offered by class counsel, no affidavit was offered, but I think the fact that they agreed to that they requested a 33% fee in the class notice is evidence that there was no negotiation there, because it's simply inconceivable that had a sophisticated, adequate, properly motivated lead plaintiff sat down and negotiated a fee in 2002 with class counsel, that they would have come out of there with a 33% fee agreement, simply because 33% is pretty much the maximum that any court has awarded, certainly in recent years, and that one would assume that the client would propose an initial offer of something lower than that, maybe 10 or 15%, they'd come out in the middle. And I think the case law bears that out. I think all actively negotiated fees that are at least that have at least been reported have ended up being less than 20%. I just want to say to a case that I just discovered on Monday in preparing for this argument. I know I have not filed it with the court, but I plan to do so tomorrow. And I ask simply permission to cite to it today orally, and it's the Bristol-Myers Squibb securities litigation. It's significant in that, it was commenced in 2002, the same year this case was, and the fee negotiated there by the by New York and Louisiana pension funds was 7.5%, and the court, in fact, even knocked down the fee further. But there's an example of a fee negotiated in 2002, 7.5%. I notice my red light is on, so I will step down unless the court has any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Pence.
Thank you.
Ms. Sickles.
May it please the court, Kay Sickles on behalf of plaintiff's counsel. There are two issues before this court today. The first issue is whether or not the objector appellant has waived much of his arguments that he presents here today and in his papers to the appellate court for failing to present them below to the district court and to plaintiff's counsel. The second issue is whether the trial court abused its discretion in awarding 30% of the gross settlement fund as fees to plaintiff's counsel and by awarding $111,054.06 in the reimbursement of expenses. I'll first turn to the waiver argument. It's a well-settled doctrine in this court that if a party litigant fails to raise an issue before the district court, it waives that the right to raise it to the appellate court. Here today, the basic reasons for that are clear. If the objector had raised these issues before the trial court, both plaintiff's counsel and the district court would have had the opportunity to address them. As it is, we never had the opportunity to prepare for them or address them before briefing the issue to the appellate court.
Now, they do indicate that Synthroid was cited to the district court.
In the objection, the objector cited merely to the district court's first opinion, where the district court awarded only or made reference only to the 15% that may have been produced by an auction. And in the objection, in the objector's papers, the objector merely cited the case and made reference to the 15%.
Cited the district court opinion?
In Synthroid, yes. There's no citation to either Synthroid 1 or Synthroid 2, the Seventh Circuit opinions, in those papers. In addition, we were all present for the final hearing before the district court, and Judge Leinenweber gave the objector multiple opportunities to augment the record, and the objector declined. As noted by the court in Recompact Disc minimum advertised price litigation, the attorney representing the objector is experienced and has appeared in many cases as an objector. While on any disregarding the experience of the objector's counsel, there would be no reason not to apply the doctrine of waiver here. But I would say in these circumstances especially, the court should apply the doctrine of waiver. The objector appellant was given every opportunity to provide for these issues on the record. This issue of the analysis that it wanted the court, that she wanted the court to undertake under Synthroid, and the reimbursement of expenses as well. I will move on to the issue of whether the trial court abused its discretion. In order for this court to find that the district court abused its discretion, it must find that it reached an erroneous conclusion of law, failed to explain a reduction, or reached a conclusion that no evidence in the record could support. I respectfully submit that there is no evidence that the district court did any of those things in this case. The district court, in fact, fully reviewed the case, gave the parties every opportunity on the record to state their positions, and made a number of findings on the record. First, the court explicitly reviewed the case law cited by both sides, made reference to that on the record, asked the parties if they would like to cite to additional cases on the record. Counsel for the objector declined. Plaintiff's counsel directed the district court to an additional case that had not been cited in the record, which was a recent opinion by Judge Norgel out of the Northern District, wherein he awarded 30% of a $39 million settlement in a securities class action. I have with me here today two recent opinions from the last 8 months, wherein securities class action litigation, a judge from the Northern District of Illinois and a judge from the District of Wisconsin, both awarded 30% of settlement funds in the range of $4 million. Those cases are In Re Shopko Securities Litigation and Miller versus Apropos. Not only did the court address the issue of whether 30% was an appropriate fee in this case, as it was in similar litigation, but I respectfully submit that the court was reviewing those cases in order to determine the market rate. And as I said, gave the objector every opportunity to provide for additional citations on the record and for it to submit evidence of what it believed the appropriate fee should be. The court then addressed additional considerations which both the Seventh Circuit and district courts in this jurisdiction have found to be relevant. It first turned to the difficulty that it believes plaintiff counsel would have in advancing the litigation. Plaintiff's counsel had submitted evidence in the record, and the district court agreed the plaintiff's counsel would in all likelihood have trouble proving that there was fraud in this case as opposed to negligence. On the record, it asked the objector if it disagreed with that conclusion, and the objector did not. The district court also addressed the objector's arguments with respect to auctions. It found that in this case, those arguments were not relevant. And I would add that the objector had every opportunity at the appropriate time in this case to raise that issue. The objector could have gotten involved in the lead plaintiff and lead counsel appointments in 2002 and never did. The district court also found that that plaintiff's counsel was experienced and able counsel who had provided for an adequate representation of the class and who had taken the case on a contingent fee risk. The court also considered the class's reaction to the settlement and fee request and noted that the only objection was the objection filed by the objector through her counsel, Mr. Pence. The district court's consideration of all of these factors and its explicit statement on the record that it had reviewed the case and the materials in full demonstrates that the district court did not abuse its discretion, that it in fact rendered a thoughtful and appropriate decision. I'll turn now to the objector's argument under Synthroid in the event this court finds that the objector has not waived the right to raise this issue. I would plainly submit that if this court finds that it should address the analysis under Synthroid 1 and 2, that those analysis did not require in this case for the district court to undertake a different analysis than it undertook. Generally, Synthroid 1 and 2 stand for the proposition that the court should look to the market rate, and I submit that the district court did that.
How? How did it look to the market rate?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that when you look to the awards in similar cases in your jurisdiction, that you are, in effect, determining what the market rate is. You are looking more, without delving into the specifics of every case, which information is difficult to get your hands on. You're looking at the result to determine what that market rate was. Now, you know, in Synthroid, the court directed the district court and the parties to look more deeply into what was essentially the basis for the market rate, because they were having difficulty reaching an end point. But I respectfully submit that Synthroid, the court was not directing that in every case counsel and the district court delve into those three detailed analysis in order to come up with what the market rate would be. Before I close, I will quickly address the expense issue. As I said earlier, neither plaintiff's counsel nor the district court had the opportunity below to address that issue. I believe that the objector has waived it. If the court finds that the objector has not waived that issue, I respectfully submit that it was harmless error for the district court to award more than $100,000. If this court even finds that it was in breach of the notice, the effect on the class will be eight one hundredths of a cent.
Didn't the notice say approximately 100,000?
I'm sorry?
Didn't the notice say approximately 100,000?
It did, and that's why I said if the court finds that it was an abuse of discretion to award more than $100,000, in the first and most prominent position in the notice. Thank you, Your Honor. It did say approximately $100,000. I see that my time is up, and I thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Sickles. Your time has expired, sir.
Oh, there's no rebuttal.
Yes, so we are entirely here.